Hi, nice to see you all. Thank you for coming. My name is Robert Ogilvie. My organization is Public Health Law and Policy. We are in Oakland. We are a group of lawyers, city planners, and policy people who try to come up with solutions to help people build healthier environments. That's basically what we do. We started out as a bunch of tobacco lawyers, and most of the anti-smoking legislation and ordinances in the state of California were written by people who I work with. The result has been that California has a very hostile environment towards smoking. We've made the unhealthy choice, the hard choice. So we have the lowest smoking rates in the country and among the lowest lung cancer rates in the country. That environmental change policy has worked a lot better than any kicking, smoking, or any sort of behavioral change approaches could ever have. And that provided a real sort of a aha moment to people in my organization who were concerned about other sorts of chronic diseases. And they started to think a couple years ago, what about if we took some of this environmental change approach and focused on obesity and diabetes and some of the other chronic diseases that are starting to plague our country now? What if we tried to make the healthy choice the easy choice? Because right now, in many communities like some of the ones that Manal was talking about, the healthy choice, the choice to be physically active, the choice to buy and eat healthy food is the hard choice, especially in low-income communities. And that's why you start to see this sort of data. You guys are all familiar with this. These are our children, and as we know, obesity rates increase as people get older, so this is a dramatic reality that's facing us in America right now, especially for minority children. You see the non-Hispanic black girls, almost 30% obesity rate. All sorts of long-term chronic disease problems will result out of that. Now, there are many reasons for this. This is not like smoking, where and lung cancer, where there's a one-in-one correlation. There are many reasons for those increasing obesity and diabetes rates. But what I'm going to focus on today is increasing access to recreational facilities in neighborhoods. There are so many places now where kids do not have safe places to play, and so their parents do not let them go outside and play. Parents would rather keep them inside because they feel that's safer, but that's having a really long-term negative effect on these children. This is Fairmead School. This is in the Central Valley of California. Veva's going to talk about the Central Valley later. For those of you who are not familiar with California geography, the state is kind of like a long rectangle that sort of lies on its side and then bends at the top half. And the Central Valley is called the Central Valley because it's a valley in the central part of the state. So it's not a very creative name, but it's geographically apt. It is the big agricultural heartland of the state, and a lot of the counties there and cities are very strapped for resources, even in the best of times. This town, Fairmead, is in Madera County. Madera County has no Parks and Recreation Department. There is one planner in the city of Madera, and he's the junior planner, and he has a responsibility for parks, so he kind of gets to it when he can. The town of Fairmead is unincorporated, and they have no parks in that town, save for a little tot lot that opened a couple years ago. What they have is Fairmead School, and what Fairmead School does is close down at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I took this picture two summers ago, and this is what the schoolyard looks like in the afternoon. 10 minutes, okay, I'm gonna motor on. And to me, this is a tragedy, okay? There are children in Fairmead, and they're not using what looks like a perfectly fine basketball court to me. There was volleyball elsewhere. This is tetherball here, but they took the balls off so they didn't get damaged. This is a public resource that is not being properly used. And to me, what this represents is a challenge for me to solve. This is not irrational from the school's point of view, okay? If you look at this, Fairmead School is financially strapped, and they want to make sure that their property is not violated. And at 4 o'clock is when their custodians go home, so they lock up to make sure that the place is intact and, you know, there's no one wandering around. That makes a lot of sense from the school's perspective. But from a social perspective, this makes no sense whatsoever. And where my organization comes in is helping schools, Parks and Rec, other public organizations and advocacy organizations figure out what they can do, what sort of agreements they can write, what sort of policies can be put in place so that the school's interests will still get protected, but so that the schoolyard can be opened for the neighbors who are paying for this after all. There are a lot of people up and down the state, I think Veva might talk about some of them, who've already figured out, I mean, not just in the state, around the country, how to engage in informal agreements with principals or school districts to leave the gate open. In a lot of places where I go, they scratch their heads and they say, what's the big deal about this joint use thing? We've already figured it out. To those places, I say, thank God for you, and keep going. But in a lot of other places, these informal agreements are too transient, especially in low-income neighborhoods. Principals are transient. They're often looking to get transferred to a better school district where they don't have to deal with whatever they have to deal with. And so where we come in is to help them figure out how to write formal agreements or how to get language committing to joint use written into some of the other formal plans or agreements that guide future development in the community. So in California, we have a thing called general plans. I think in Colorado, they're called comprehensive plans. Every community by law has to have one. They have to be updated every 10 to 20 years. We are starting to see communities, and we're starting to help communities put commitments to joint use into the general plans. Redevelopment agencies, I think they're called urban renewal here in Colorado. You also have downtown development agencies who are very active over in the lower downtown. We are starting to get them and help them write commitments to joint use into the plans that they're engaged in so that when any public facility gets built or if they help build a school facility, that sort of written into the title, written into whatever documents are governing the use of that facility is a commitment to joint use. Joint use agreements, of course, are not the complete solution because, well, we found lots of places where they have joint use agreements and they're not in force. The people who wrote them have moved on. The new people either disregarded them or didn't know they existed at all. They are a partial solution to the problem. Most states have a lot of language in their state code already committing to joint use. I say this in California, and I put this up so that when people are in the audience and they say, well, you know, I've got skeptics who don't want to do joint use in my community. I say, well, look, you know, here are all these parts of the state constitution that already call for joint use. They don't mandate it, and I see one of the governor's staffers here, and maybe they're figuring out a way to mandate joint use in the state constitution. I'm talking about you, Peter. But but anyhow, I would be remiss if I didn't say that it's important to realize that schools have needs. I know, are there anyone here in the audience from a school district? No, okay, so public health people often make the mistake of looking at these school districts like a sort of a big turkey that can be plucked. And I've got 5 minutes, okay. Schools act rationally, and schools restrict access to their facilities for what they think are rational reasons. And when we engage in joint use, we have to respect that, and we have to understand what it is that's important for the school. This picture is taken in Palo Alto. This is the elementary school where my wife went to. And they have joint use agreements that leave the schoolyards open after hours. But they're very, very, very forthright about, you know, protection of property, safety of students, and regulations that must be followed. Otherwise access will be restricted in the future. And so these sorts of regulations can be written and should be written into any joint use agreement so that the needs of the school are first and foremost. I want to talk a little bit about this toolkit we wrote called Opening School Grounds to the Community After Hours. Written with support from the California Endowment and the State Public Health Department. It is available for you free on our website. Our website is healthyplanning.org. There are lots of different things in here, including some checklists on steps to take to write a joint use agreement. And there are four model joint use agreements in the back that you can take and lift out and take to your city attorney or your town attorney and get them to tweak it a little bit so that it works for your community. And the four types of joint use we talk about are, one, unlocking the gates. This is a lot of people think this is a real sort of simple first step to letting community residents have access to recreational facilities that are in the schoolyard. And again, this is Palo Verde's school in Palo Alto. And here, they unlock the gates every day at this time, and the community has access to it. They lock it during school hours, they unlock it afterwards. We also have a model agreement that will help you, write a joint use agreement that where you can gain access to school indoor or outdoor facilities. This one deals a lot more with liability. Liability is a very big issue. Maintenance, potential repairs of school facilities, and once you're starting to get indoor, the school district really starts to get a little bit more concerned about potential damage to the facilities. If you write a joint use agreement that brings in a partner like a park and recreation agency or a Boys and Girls Club, there's a lot you can do with the language to help protect the school's interest and then make sure that the partner is responsible for these sorts of things while they're in charge. There's a third type of model agreement where we talk about gaining access to facilities for programming. This is very common. I am a certified lifeguard and I learned to swim in Parks and Rec programs in Toronto, Ontario, in public high schools. So long-standing tradition where the Parks and Rec uses public high schools for swimming programs. YMCAs do it as well. We've got a model joint use agreement for that. And in this tough times, you're seeing a lot more of these sorts of reciprocal access and partner agreements coming up. This is in El Monte in Southern California. You're starting to see cities and school districts get into agreements around development where they jointly develop a facility that's used by the school at certain times of the day and used by the city for programming at other times of the day. There's even one place called Fontana down in San Bernardino County where they had two projects going up across the street from each other, a community recreation facility and a new high school. And the school district and the city council put their heads together, figured out the entire recreation need of the whole town, and they built some of the facility at the high school, they built some of the facility across the street. And that way, they didn't duplicate what each other was doing, and they got a lot more bang for their buck, and they open up access to each other with joint use agreements. A couple things that I really want to stress. Liability, you can't wish it away. It's real. And you need to put language in there, especially if you're dealing with a swimming pool, to protect people from liability. 1 minute. I mentioned that joint use agreement is just a partial solution, that the relationships and keeping it going are critical. These are some of the most critical people. They're the ones who have to show up on a Saturday morning to unlock the gate. The principal is not coming on Saturday morning to unlock the gate. And in your relationship building and your agreement drafting, it's critical to think of the needs of the custodians. I'm just going to fast forward through these things. This is from Santa Barbara. And it's important to have language in there talking about why you're doing these things, which facilities are going to be open, and for what. You don't have to throw everything open. To talk about how it's going to be maintained and developed or used, and to talk about liability and holding each other indemnified. It's great to have a partner because partners like Parks and Rec have liability insurance, and school districts like to partner with other organizations that have liability insurance, and that's very helpful. There's money available for this. I know in the state of California, there's state funding streams that are only available to schools if they enter into joint use agreements with others. And there's lots of other different state and federal allocations. If there's new development happening, some of the development driven, the developer fees can be used for joint use facilities. Don't forget that this is a political process, and I love the slide that Manal put up that talked about all the different things that are going on in the state of California. We come in with the legal technical work, but the political work to create the local demand for this is really critical for setting the stage and making this happen. And without it, none of this sort of stuff would happen. And that's it. And I will just show you, that's our contact information. And if you need any of these products, they're available for free on our website, so please get in touch with us.